is nothing more than the habit of thinking. But don't we all think? Isn't that part of being human? Well, most of us do think. The problem is that most people think just enough to survive. What I am speaking about with this ritual is thinking enough to thrive. When you read Ben Franklin's biography, you will see what I mean. Every evening, after a full day of productive work, he would retire to a silent corner of his home and reflect on his day. He would consider all of his actions, and whether they were positive and constructive, or whether they were of the negative sort, in need of repair. By clearly knowing what he was doing wrong in his days, he could take immediate steps to improve and advance along the path of self-mastery. The sages did the same. Every night they would retire to the sanctuary of their huts, covered by fragrant rose petals, and sit in deep contemplation. Yogi Raman would actually take a written inventory of his day. What kinds of things would he write down? I asked. First, he would list all of his activities, from the personal care activities of his morning, to his interactions with the other sages, to his forays into the forest in search of firewood and fresh food. Interestingly, he would also write down the thoughts he had run through his mind during that particular day. Isn't that hard to do? I can hardly remember what I thought 5 minutes ago, let alone 12 hours ago. Not if you practice this ritual daily. You see, anyone can attain the kind of results I have attained. Anyone. The real problem is that too many people suffer from that dreadful disease known as excusitis. I think I might have contracted that one in the past, I said, in full knowledge of what my wise friend was saying. Stop making excuses and just do it, Julian exclaimed, his voice resonating with the strength of conviction. Do what? Take the time to think. Get into the regular habit of personal introspection. Once Yogi Raman had listed all that he had done and all that he had thought in one column, he would then do an assessment in another column. As he was confronted by his activities and thoughts in the written form, he asked himself whether they were positive in nature. If they were, he resolved to continue giving his precious energy to them, as they would pay huge dividends in the long run. And if they were negative? Then he would come up with a clear course of action to get rid of them. I think an example might help me. Can it be personal? Julian asked. Sure. I'd love to know some of your innermost thoughts, I suggested. Actually, I was thinking about yours. We both started to giggle like a couple of kids in a schoolyard. All right, you always did get your own way. Okay, let's go through just a few of the things that you did today. Write them down on that piece of paper on the coffee table, Julian instructed. I started to realize that something important was about to happen. This was the first time in years that I had actually taken the time to do nothing but reflect on the things I was doing and the thoughts that I was thinking. It was all so strange and yet so intelligent. After all, how could I ever hope to improve myself and my life if I hadn't even taken the time to figure out what I was supposed to improve? Where do I start? I asked. Start with what you did this morning and progress through your day. Just hit a few of the highlights. We still have a fair amount of ground to cover, and I want to get back to Yogi Raman's fable in a few minutes. Fine. I woke up at 6:30 to the sound of my electric rooster, I joked. Get serious and keep going, Julian replied firmly. Okay. Then I showered and shaved, gobbled down a waffle, and rushed off to work. And what about your family? They were all asleep. Anyway, once I got to the office, I noticed that my 7:30 appointment had been waiting there since 7, and boy was he furious. What was your response? I fought back. What was I supposed to do, let him push me around? Okay. Then what happened? Well, things went from bad to worse. The courthouse called and told me that Judge Wildebeest needed to see me in his chambers, and if I wasn't there within 10 minutes, heads would roll. You remember Wildebeest, don't you? You were the one who nicknamed him Judge Wild Beast after he held you in contempt for parking your Ferrari in his parking spot, I recalled, breaking into laughter. You would have to bring that up, wouldn't you? Julian replied, his eyes revealing the remnants of that mischievous twinkle he was once well known for. Anyway, I rushed down to the courthouse and had another argument with one of the clerks. By the time I got back to the office, there were 27 phone messages waiting for me, all marked urgent. Need I go on? Please do. Well, on the way home, Jenny called me in the car and asked me to stop by her mother's house and pick up one of those amazing pies my mother-in-law is famous for. Problem was that when I took that exit, I found myself in the middle of a gridlock that was worse than anything I have seen in ages. So there I was, in the middle of rush hour traffic, in 95-degree heat, shaking with stress and feeling that even more time was slipping away. How did you respond? I cursed the traffic, I said with complete honesty. I was actually shouting out loud inside my car. Do you want to know what I said? I don't think that would be the kind of thing that would nourish the garden of my mind, Julian responded with a soft smile. But it might make for good fertilizer. No thanks. Maybe we should stop there. Just take a second and look at your day. Obviously, in retrospect, there are at least a few things that you would do differently if you had the chance. Obviously. Like what? Well, first, in a perfect world, I would get up earlier. I don't think I'm doing myself any favors by hitting the ground running. I'd like to have a little peace in the morning and ease myself into the day. The heart of the rose technique you told me about earlier sounds like it would be fun. Also, I really would like to have the family around the breakfast table, even if only for a bowl of cereal. It would give me a better sense of balance. I always seem to feel that I never spend enough time with Jenny and the kids. But it is a perfect world, and you have a perfect life. You do have the power to control your day. You do have the power to think good thoughts. You do have the power to live your dreams, Julian observed, his voice rising. I am realizing this. I really am starting to feel that I can change. Great. Continue reflecting on your day, he instructed. Well, I wish I hadn't yelled at my client. I wish I hadn't argued with the court clerk, and I wish I hadn't screamed at the traffic. The traffic doesn't care, does it? It just keeps on being traffic, I noted. I think you now see the power of the ritual of personal reflection. By looking at what you were doing, how you were spending your day, and the thoughts you were thinking, you give yourself a benchmark for measuring improvement. The only way to improve tomorrow is to know what you did wrong today. And come up with a clear plan so that it doesn't happen again, I added. Precisely. There is nothing wrong with making mistakes. Mistakes are part of life and essential for growth. It's like that saying, happiness comes through good judgment. Good judgment comes through experience. And experience comes through bad judgment. But there is something very wrong with making the same mistakes over and over again, day in and day out. This shows a complete lack of self-awareness, the very quality that separates humans from animals. I've never heard that one before. Well, it's true. Only a human being can step out of himself and analyze what he is doing right and what he is doing wrong. A dog cannot do this. A bird cannot do this. Even a monkey cannot do it. But you can. This is what the ritual of personal reflection is all about. Figure out what is right and what is wrong in your days and in your life. Then set about making immediate improvements. Lots to think about, Julian. Lots to think about, I offered reflectively.
How about thinking about the sixth ritual for radiant living, the ritual of early awakening? Uh-oh, I think I know what's coming. One of the best pieces of advice I learned in that far-off oasis of savannah was to rise with the sun and to start the day off well. Most of us sleep far more than we need to. The average person can get by on 6 hours and remain perfectly healthy and alert. Sleep is really nothing more than a habit, and like any other habit, you can train yourself to achieve the result you want. Sleeping less in this case. But if I get up too early, I really do feel exhausted, I said. For the first few days, you will feel very tired,
I'll freely admit this. You might even feel this way for the first week of getting up nice and early. Please see this as a small measure of short-term pain for a large measure of long-term gain. You will always feel a little discomfort when you are installing a new habit. It's sort of like breaking in a new pair of shoes. At first, it's a little hard to wear them, but soon they fit like a glove. As I told you earlier, pain is often the precursor to personal growth. Don't dread it. Instead, embrace it. Okay, I like the idea of training myself to get up earlier. First, let me ask you, what does early mean? Another fine question. There is no ideal time. Just like everything else I have shared with you so far, do what is right for you. Remember Yogi Raman's admonishment. Nothing to extremes, everything in moderation. Getting up with the sun sounds extreme. Actually, it isn't. There are few things more natural than rising with the glory of the first rays of a new day. The sages believed that sunshine was a gift from heaven, and while they were careful not to overexpose themselves, they regularly had sun baths and often could be seen dancing playfully in the early morning sunshine. I firmly believe that this was another key to their extraordinary longevity. "Do you sunbathe?" I asked. "Absolutely. The sun rejuvenates me. When I grow tired, it keeps my mood bright. In the ancient culture of the East, the sun was thought to be a connection to the soul. People worshipped it, as it allowed their crops to flourish along with their spirits. Sunlight will release your vitality and restore your emotional and physical vibrancy. It is a delightful physician, when visited in moderation, of course. Alas, I digress. The point is to get up early every day. How do I build this ritual into my routine? Here are a couple of quick tips. First, never forget that it is the quality and not the quantity of sleep that is important. It is better to have 6 hours of uninterrupted deep sleep than even 10 hours of disturbed sleep. The whole idea is to provide your body with rest, so that its natural processes can repair and restore your physical dimension to its natural state of health, a state that is diminished through the stresses and struggles of daily use. Many of the habits of the sages are based on the principle that one must strive for quality rest rather than quantity sleep. For example, Yogi Raman would never eat past 8 p.m. He said that the digestive activity it induced would reduce the quality of his sleep. Another example was the sage's habit of meditating to the soft sounds of their harp immediately before heading off to sleep. What was the reason behind this? Let me ask you, John, what do you do before you go to sleep every night? I watch the news with Jenny, the same as most people I know. I kind of thought so, replied Julian, with a mysterious twinkle in his eyes. I don't get it. What could possibly be wrong with getting a little shot of the news before I go to sleep? The 10-minute period before you sleep and the 10-minute period after you wake up are profoundly influential on your subconscious mind. Only the most inspiring and serene thoughts should be programmed into your mind at those times. You make the mind sound like a computer. That's a pretty fair way to look at it. What you put in is what you get out. Even more important is the fact that you alone are the programmer. By determining the thoughts that go in, you also are determining precisely what will come out. So, before you go to sleep, don't watch the news or argue with anyone, or even go over the day's events in your mind's eye. Relax. Drink a cup of herbal tea if you like. Listen to some soft classical music, and prepare yourself to drift off into a rich, renewing slumber. Makes sense. The better the sleep, the less I will need. Exactly. And remember the ancient rule of 21. If you do anything for 21 days in a row, it will be installed as a habit. So stay with the early rising routine for about 3 weeks before you give up because it feels too uncomfortable. By then, it will be a part of your life. Within short order, you will be able to rise at 5:30 a.m. or even at 5 a.m. with ease, ready to savor the splendor of another great day. Okay, so let's say that I am getting up every day at 5:30. What do I do?
Your questions show that you are thinking, my friend. I appreciate this. Once you are up, there are many things you can do. The fundamental principle to keep in mind is the importance of starting your day off well. As I've suggested, the thoughts you think and the actions you take in the first 10 minutes after you wake up have a very marked effect on the rest of your day. Seriously? Absolutely. Think positive thoughts. Give a prayer of thanks for all you have. Work on your gratitude list. Listen to some great music. Watch the sun come up. Or perhaps go for a quick walk in natural surroundings if you feel up to it. The sages would actually make themselves laugh, whether they felt like it or not, just to get the happiness juices flowing early in the morning.
Julian, I'm trying very hard to keep my cup empty, and I think you will agree that I've done pretty well for a novice. But that really sounds odd, even for a band of monks living high in the Himalayas.
But it is not. Take a guess how many times the average 4-year-old laughs in a day.
Who knows?
I do. 300. Now, guess how many times the average adult in our society laughs in the course of a day.
50, I tried.
Try 15, Julian said, smiling in satisfaction. You see my point? Laughing is medicine for the soul. Even if you don't feel like it, look in the mirror and laugh for a couple of minutes. You can't help but feel fantastic. William James said, "We don't laugh because we are happy. We are happy because we laugh." So start your day on a delightful footing. Laugh, play, and give thanks for all you have. Every day will be an exquisitely rewarding one.
What do you do to start your day off on a positive footing?
Actually, I have developed quite a sophisticated morning routine that includes everything from the heart of the rose to drinking a couple of glasses of freshly squeezed fruit juice. But there is one strategy in particular that I would like to share with you.
Sounds important.
It is. Shortly after you have awakened, go into your sanctuary of silence. Get still and focused. Then ask yourself this question. What would I do today if today was my last? The key is to really get into the meaning of this question. Mentally list all the things you would do, the people you would call, and the moments you would savor. Envision yourself doing these things with great energy. Visualize how you would treat your family and your friends. Even picture how you would treat total strangers if today was your last day on the planet. As I told you earlier, when you live every day as if it was your last, your life will take on a magical quality. And this brings me to the seventh of the rituals of radiant living, the ritual of music.
I think I'm going to love this one, I replied.
I'm sure you will. The sages loved their music. It gave them the same spiritual boost as the sun did. Music made them laugh, it made them dance, and it made them sing. It will do the same for you. Never forget the power of music. Spend a little time with it every day, even if it is listening to a soft piece on a cassette while you drive to work. When you feel down or weary, play some music. It is one of the finest motivators I know of.
Aside from yourself, I exclaimed sincerely,
just listening to you makes me feel great. You really have changed, Julian, and not just on the outside. Gone is your old cynicism. Gone is your former negativity. Gone is your old aggressiveness. You really do seem to be at peace with yourself. You have touched me tonight.
Hey, there's more, shouted Julian with his fist in the air. Let's keep going.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Okay. The eighth ritual is the ritual of the spoken word. The sages had a series of mantras that they would recite morning, noon, and night. They told me that this practice was immensely effective in keeping them focused, strong, and happy.
What's a mantra? I asked.
A mantra is nothing more than a collection of words strung together to create a positive effect. In Sanskrit,
Man means mind, and tra means freeing. So a mantra is a phrase that is designed to free the mind. And believe me, John, mantras accomplish this objective in a very powerful way. Are you using mantras in your daily routine? I sure am. They are my faithful companions wherever I go. Whether I am on the bus, walking to the library, or watching the world go by in a park, I am constantly affirming all that is good in my world through mantras. So mantras are spoken. They do not have to be. Written affirmations are also very effective. But I have found that repeating a mantra aloud has a wonderful effect on my spirit. When I need to feel motivated, I might repeat, "I am inspired, disciplined, and energized," out loud, 200 or 300 times. To maintain the supreme sense of self-confidence I have cultivated, I repeat, "I am strong, able, and calm." I even use mantras to keep me youthful and vital, Julian admitted. How could a mantra keep you young? Words affect the mind in a pronounced way. Whether they are spoken or written, they are powerful influences. While what you say to others is important, even more important is what you say to yourself. Self-talk? Exactly. You are what you think about all day long. You are also what you say to yourself all day long. If you say that you are old and tired, this mantra will be manifested in your external reality. If you say you are weak and lack enthusiasm, this too will be the nature of your world. But if you say that you are healthy, dynamic, and fully alive, your life will be transformed. You see, the words you say to yourself affect your self-image, and your self-image determines what actions you take. For example, if your self-image is one of a person who lacks the confidence to do anything of value, you will only be able to take actions that are aligned with this trait. On the other hand, if your self-image is one of a radiant individual who is fearless, again, all your actions will correspond to this quality. Your self-image is a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts. How so? If you believe that you are unable to do something, let's say, find that perfect partner, or live a stress-free life, your beliefs will affect your self-image. In turn, your self-image will prevent you from taking steps to find the perfect partner or to create a serene life for yourself. It will actually sabotage any efforts you might make in this direction. Why does it work that way? Simple. Your self-image is a governor of sorts. It will never let you act in a way that is inconsistent with it. The beautiful thing is that you can change your self-image, just like you can change everything else in your life if it is not serving to enhance it. Mantras are a great way to accomplish this objective. "And when I change my inner world, I change my outer world," I said dutifully. "My, how quickly you learn," Julian said, giving me the thumbs-up sign he had used so much in his former life as a star litigator. Which leads us into the 9th ritual of radiant living quite nicely. This is the ritual of a congruent character. It is sort of an offshoot of the self-image concept we were just talking about. Simply stated, this ritual requires you to take daily incremental action to build your character. Strengthening your character affects the way you see yourself and the actions you take. The actions you take come together to form your habits, and this is important. Your habits lead you to your destiny. Perhaps Yogi Raman articulated the formula best when he stated, "You sow a thought, you reap an action. Reap an action, you sow a habit. Sow a habit, you reap a character. Sow a character, you reap your destiny." What kind of thing should I do to build my character? Anything that cultivates your virtues. Before you ask me what I mean by virtues, let me clarify the concept. The wise people of the Himalayas believed strongly that a virtuous life was a meaningful life. So they governed all of their actions by a series of timeless principles. But I thought you said they governed their lives by their purpose. Yes, this is quite so. but their life's calling included living in a manner congruent to these principles, ones that their ancestors held dear to their hearts for thousands of years.
"What are these principles, Julian?" I asked.
"They are, simply stated, industry, compassion, humility, patience, honesty, and courage. When all your actions are congruent and aligned with these principles, you will feel a deep sense of inner harmony and peace. Living this way will inevitably lead you to spiritual success. This is because you will be doing what is right. You will be acting in a way that is in accordance with the laws of nature and the laws of the universe. This is when you will start to tap into the energy of another dimension. Call it a higher power, if you will. This is also when your life will move from the ordinary into the realm of the extraordinary, and you begin to sense the sacredness of your being. It is the first step to lifelong enlightenment."
"Have you tasted this experience?" I asked.
"I have, and I believe you will too. Do the right things. Act in a way that is congruent with your true character. Act with integrity. Be guided by your heart. The rest will take care of itself."
"You are never alone, you know," replied Julian.
"What do you mean?"
"I'll explain it to you another time, perhaps.
For now, remember that you must do little things every day to build your character. As Emerson said, character is higher than intellect. A great soul will be strong to live as well as to think. Your character is built when you act in a way that corresponds with the principles I've just mentioned. If you fail to do this, true happiness will always elude you."
"And the final ritual?"
"This is the all-important ritual of simplicity. This ritual requires you to live a simple life. As Yogi Raman said, one must never live in the thick of thin things. Focus only on your priorities, those activities that are truly meaningful. Your life will be uncluttered, rewarding, and exceptionally peaceful. This I promise you." He was right. The moment I started to separate the wheat from the chaff, harmony filled my life. I stopped living at the frenetic pace to which I had grown accustomed. I stopped living my life in the eye of the tornado. Instead, I slowed down and took the time to smell the proverbial roses.
"What things did you do to cultivate simplicity?"
"I stopped wearing expensive clothes. I kicked my addiction to 6 newspapers a day. I stopped needing to be available to everyone all the time. I became a vegetarian, and I ate less. Basically, I reduced my needs. You see, John, unless you reduce your needs, you will never be fulfilled. You will always be like that gambler in Las Vegas, staying at the roulette wheel for just one more spin in the hope that your lucky number will come up. You will always want more than you have. How can you ever be happy?"
"But earlier you told me that happiness comes from achievement. Now you are telling me to reduce my needs and be content with less. Isn't this a paradox?"
"Excellent point, John. Brilliant, in fact. It might seem like a contradiction, but it isn't. Lifelong happiness does come through striving to realize your dreams. You are at your best when you are moving forward. The key is not to make your happiness contingent on finding that elusive pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. For example, even though I was a millionaire many times over, I told myself that success to me meant having $300 million in my bank account. This was a recipe for disaster."
"$300 million?" I asked in disbelief.
"$300 million. So no matter how much I had, I was never satisfied. I was always unhappy. It was nothing more than greed. I can now admit this freely. It was much like the story of King Midas. I'm sure you have heard that one."
"Sure. The man who loved gold so much, he prayed that everything he touched would turn to gold. When his wish was granted, he rejoiced. That was until he realized that he couldn't eat because his food had turned to gold, and so on and so forth."
"Right. Similarly, I was so money-driven that I couldn't enjoy all that I had.
You know, there came a time when all that I could eat was bread and water, Julian said, growing very quiet and pensive. Are you serious? I always thought you ate at the best restaurants with all those celebrity friends of yours. That was in the early days. Not many people know about this, but the burden of my out-of-control lifestyle gave me a bleeding ulcer. I couldn't even eat a hot dog without getting sick. What a life! All that money, and all I could eat was bread and water. It was pathetic, really. Julian caught himself. But I'm not one to live in the past. It was another one of life's great lessons. As I told you earlier, pain is a powerful teacher. To transcend pain, I had to first experience it. I wouldn't be where I am today without it, he said stoically. Any ideas on what I should do to bring the ritual of simplicity into my own life? I asked. There are so many things you can do. Even little things will make a difference. Like what? Stop picking up the phone every time it rings. Stop wasting time reading junk mail. Stop eating out 3 times a week. Give up your golf club membership and spend more time with your kids. Spend a day a week without your watch. Watch the sunrise every few days. Sell your cellular phone and dump the pager. Need I continue? Julian asked rhetorically. I get the point. But sell the cell phone? I asked anxiously, feeling as a baby might at the doctor's suggestion that his umbilical cord should be cut. Like I said, my duty is to share the wisdom I have learned through my journey with you. You need not apply every strategy to make your life work. Try the techniques and use those that feel right to you. I know, nothing to extremes, everything in moderation. Precisely. I have to admit, though, every one of your strategies sounds great. But will they really bring about profound shifts in my life in only 30 days? It will take even less than 30 days. And even more, said Julian, with his trademark look of dimpled mischievousness. Here we go again. Do explain, O wise one. Julian will be fine, although wise one would have looked formidable on my old letterhead, he joked. I say it will take less than 30 days, because true life change is spontaneous. Spontaneous? Yes, it happens in the blink of an eye. The very moment you decide from the deepest core of your being that you will raise your life to its highest level. In that instant, you will be a changed person, one set on the course of his destiny. And why longer than 30 days? I promise you, but by practicing these strategies and tools, you will see marked improvements in 1 month from this moment. You will have more energy, less worries, more creativity, and less stress in every aspect of your life. Having said this, the sage's methods are not of the quick fix kind. They are ageless traditions that are meant to be applied daily for the rest of your days. If you stop applying them, you will find that you will gradually slide back into your old ways. After Julian had explained the 10 rituals for radiant living to me, he paused. I know that you want me to keep going, so I will. I believe so strongly in what I am sharing with you that I don't mind keeping you up all night. Perhaps this is a good time to get a little deeper. What exactly do you mean? I think all that I have heard tonight is pretty deep, I said in surprise. The secrets I have explained will allow you and all those you come into contact with to create the lives you desire. But there is so much more to the philosophy of the sages of Sivana than meets the eye. What I have taught you up to now has been immensely practical. But you must know something of the underlying spiritual current that flows through the principles I have outlined. If you do not understand what I am speaking about, don't worry at this point. Simply take it in and chew on it for a while. You can digest it later. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Precisely, said Julian, now smiling. You always were a quick study. Okay, let's hear the spiritual stuff, I said energetically, unaware that it was nearly 2:30 in the morning.
Within you lies the sun, the moon, the sky, and all the wonders of this universe. The intelligence that created these wonders is the same force that created you. All things around you come from the same source. We are all one.
I'm not sure I follow you.
Every being on this earth, every object on this earth, has a soul. All souls flow into one. This is the soul of the universe. You see, John, when you nourish your own mind and your own spirit, you are really feeding the soul of the universe. When you improve yourself, you are improving the lives of all those around you. And when you have the courage to advance confidently in the direction of your dreams, you begin to draw upon the power of the universe. As I told you earlier, life gives you what you ask of it. It is always listening. So self-mastery and Kaizen will help me help others by helping me help myself. Something like that. As you enrich your mind, as you care for your body, and as you nurture your spirit, you will come to understand exactly what I am saying. Julian, I know you mean well, but self-mastery is a pretty high ideal for a 215-pound family man, who up to now has spent more time on client development than personal development. What happens if I fail? Failure is not having the courage to try. Nothing more and nothing less. The only thing standing between most people and their dreams is the fear of failure. Yet failure is essential to success in any endeavor. Failure tests us and allows us to grow. It offers us lessons and guides us along the path of enlightenment. The teachers of the East say that every arrow that hits the bullseye is the result of 100 misses. It is a fundamental law of nature to profit through loss. Never fear failure. Failure is your friend. Embrace failure? I asked in disbelief. The universe favors the brave. When you resolve, once and for all, to lift your life to its highest level, the strength of your soul will guide you. Yogi Raman believed that everyone's destiny was laid out for them at birth. This path always leads to a magical place filled with magnificent treasures. It was up to each individual to develop the courage to walk this way. There is a story he shared with me that I would like to pass on to you. Once in ancient India, there was an evil giant who owned a magnificent castle overlooking the sea. As the giant had been away for many years fighting in wars, the children of the nearby village used to come into the giant's beautiful garden and play with great delight. One day the giant returned and threw all of the young children out of his garden. "Never return here," he yelled, as he slammed the huge oak door in disgust. He then erected a huge marble wall around the garden to keep the children out. Winter came with bitter cold, which is native to the northernmost parts of the Indian subcontinent, and the giant wished the warmth would soon return. Spring visited the village that lay below the giant's castle, but the icy claws of winter refused to leave his garden. Then, one day, the giant finally smelled the fragrances of spring and felt the radiance of the sun through his windows. "Spring has finally returned," he cried, running out into the garden. But the giant was unprepared for the sight that greeted him. The children of the village had somehow managed to climb over the castle wall and were playing in the garden. It was because of their presence that the garden had been transformed from a wintry wasteland into a lush place filled with roses, daffodils, and orchids. All the children laughed and giggled with joy, but one. From the corner of his eye, the giant spotted a little boy who was much smaller than all the other children. Tears ran from his eyes as he did not have the strength to climb the wall into the garden. The giant felt sad for this boy, and for the first time in his life regretted his evil ways. "I will help this child," he said, running towards him. When all the other children saw the giant coming, they ran from the garden, fearing for their lives. But the tiny little boy stood his ground.
I will slay the giant, he stammered. I will defend our playground.
As the giant approached the child, he opened his arms. I am a friend, he said. I have come to help you over the wall and into the garden. This will be your garden now. The little boy, now a hero among the children, rejoiced in happiness and gave the giant the golden necklace that he had always worn around his neck. This is my lucky charm, he said. I want you to have it. From that day on, the children played with the giant in his wonderful garden. But the brave little boy whom the giant loved the most never did return. As time went on, the giant grew ill and frail. The children continued to play in the garden, but the giant no longer had the strength to keep them company. In those quiet days, it was the little boy who the giant thought of the most. One day, in the midst of a particularly bitter winter, the giant glanced out his window and saw a truly miraculous sight. Though most of the garden was covered in snow, at the center of the garden there stood a magnificent rose bush, overflowing with spectacularly colored flowers. Next to the roses stood the little boy who the giant loved. The boy was smiling sweetly. The giant danced with delight and rushed outside to embrace the child. Where have you been all these years, my young friend? I've missed you with all my heart. The boy was thoughtful in his response. Many years ago you lifted me over the wall into your magical garden. Now I have come to take you into mine. Later that day, when the children came to visit the giant, they found him lying lifeless on the ground. From head to toe, he was covered by a thousand beautiful roses. Always be brave, John, like that little boy. Stand your ground and follow your dreams. They will lead you to your destiny. Follow your destiny, it will lead you into the wonders of the universe. And always follow the wonders of the universe, for they will lead you to a special garden filled with roses. As I looked over at Julian to tell him that this story had touched me deeply, I saw something that startled me. This rock-hard legal gladiator, who had spent the better part of his life defending the rich and famous, had started to weep. Chapter 9. Action Summary. Julian's Wisdom in a Nutshell. The Symbol. The Sumo Wrestler. The Virtue. Practice Kaizen. The Wisdom. Self-mastery is the DNA of life mastery. Success on the outside begins within. Enlightenment comes through the consistent cultivation of your mind, body, and soul. The Techniques. Do the things you fear. The 10 Ancient Rituals for Radiant Living. Quotable quote. The universe favors the brave. When you resolve to live your life to its highest level, the strength of your soul will guide you to a magical place with magnificent treasures. The monk who sold his Ferrari. Chapter 10. The Power of Discipline. Sure I am that this day we are masters of our fate, that the task which has been set before us is not above our strengths, that its pangs and toils are not beyond my endurance. As long as we have faith in our own cause and an unconquerable will to win, victory will not be denied us. Winston Churchill. Julian continued to use Yogi Raman's mystical fable as the cornerstone for the wisdom he was sharing with me. I had learned of the garden within my mind, a storehouse of power and potential. Through the symbol of the lighthouse, I had learned of the overriding importance of a definite purpose in life and the effectiveness of goal setting. By the example of the 9-foot-tall, 900-pound Japanese sumo wrestler, I had received instruction on the timeless concept of Kaizen, and the bountiful benefits that self-mastery would bring. Little did I know that the best was still to come. You will recall that our friend the sumo wrestler was stark naked. "Except for the pink wire cable covering his private parts," I interjected gamely.
"Right," applauded Julian.
"The pink wire cable will serve to remind you of the power of self-control and discipline in building a richer, happier, and more enlightened life. My teachers in Sivana were undoubtedly the most healthy, contented, and serene people I have ever met. They were also the most disciplined. These sages taught me that the virtue of self-discipline was like a wire cable. Have you ever really taken the time to study a wire cable, John?"
"It hasn't been high on my priority list," I confessed with a quick grin.
"Well, have a look at one sometime. You will see that it consists of many thin, tiny wires placed one on top of the other. Alone, each one is flimsy and weak. But together, their sum is much greater than their constituent parts, and the cable becomes tougher than iron. Self-control and willpower are similar to this. To build a will of iron, it is essential to take small, tiny acts in tribute to the virtue of personal discipline. Routinely performed, the little acts pile one on top of another to eventually produce an abundance of inner strength. Perhaps the old African proverb says it best. When spider webs unite, they tie up a lion. When you liberate your willpower, you become the master of your personal world. When you continually practice the ancient art of self-government, there will be no hurdle too high for you to overcome, no challenge too tough for you to surmount, and no crisis too hot for you to cool down. Self-discipline will provide you with the mental reserves required to persevere when life throws you one of its little curves. I must also alert you to the fact that the lack of willpower is a mental disease," Julian added surprisingly. "If you suffer from this weakness, make it a priority to stamp it out quickly. An abundance of willpower and discipline is one of the chief attributes of all those with strong characters and wonderful lives. Willpower allows you to do what you said you would do, when you said you would do it. It is willpower that allows you to get up at 5 a.m, to cultivate your mind through meditation, or to feed your spirit by a walk in the woods when a cozy bed beckons you on a cold winter's day. It is willpower that allows you to hold your tongue when a less actualized person insults you or does something you disagree with. It is willpower that pushes your dreams forward when the odds appear to be insurmountable. It is willpower that offers you the inner power to keep your commitments to others, and perhaps even more importantly, to yourself."
"Is it really that important?"
"Most certainly, my friend. It is the essential virtue of every person who has created a life rich with passion, possibility, and peace." Julian then reached into his robe and pulled out a shiny silver locket, the kind you might see in a museum exhibit on ancient Egypt. "You shouldn't have," I joked. "The sages of Sivana gave this gift to me on my last evening with them. It was a joyous, loving celebration between members of a family who lived life to the fullest. It was one of the greatest and saddest nights of my life. I didn't want to leave the nirvana of Sivana. It was my sanctuary, an oasis of all that was good in this world. The sages had become my spiritual brothers and sisters. I left part of myself high in the Himalayas that evening," Julian said, his voice growing soft. "What are the words engraved on the locket?"
"Here. I'll read them to you. Never forget them, John. They have really helped me when times got tough. I pray that they also bathe you in comfort during times of difficulty. They say, through the steel of discipline, you will forge a character rich with courage and peace. Through the virtue of will, you are destined to rise to life's highest ideal and live within a heavenly mansion filled with all that is good, joyful, and vital. Without them, you are lost like a mariner without a compass, one who eventually sinks with his ship. I have never really thought about the importance of self-control, although there have been many times I've wished I had more discipline, I admitted. Are you saying that I can actually build discipline, the way my teenage son builds his biceps at the local gym? The analogy is an excellent one. You condition your willpower just as your son conditions his body at the gym. Anyone, no matter how weak or lethargic they might currently be, can grow disciplined within a relatively short time. Mahatma Gandhi is a good example. When most people think of this modern-day saint, they remember a man who could go weeks without food in the pursuit of his cause, and endure tremendous pain for the sake of his convictions. But when you study Gandhi's life, you will see that he was not always a master of self-control. You're not going to tell me that Gandhi was a chocoholic, are you? Not quite, John. As a young lawyer in South Africa, he was given to passionate outbursts, and the disciplines of fasting and meditation were as foreign to him as the simple white loincloth that eventually became his personal trademark in his later years. Are you saying that with the right blend of training and preparation, I could have the same level of willpower as Mahatma Gandhi? Everyone is different. One of the fundamental principles that Yogi Raman taught me was that truly enlightened people never seek to be like others. Rather, they seek to be superior to their former selves. Don't race against others. Race against yourself, Julian replied. When you have self-control, you will have the resolve to do the things you have always wanted to do. For you, it may be training for a marathon, or mastering the art of whitewater rafting, or even giving up the law to become an artist. Whatever it is you are dreaming of, whether it is material riches or spiritual riches, I will not be your judge. I will simply tell you that all these things will be within your grasp when you cultivate your sleeping reserves of willpower. Julian added, building self-control and discipline into your life will also bring you a tremendous sense of freedom. This alone will change things. What do you mean? Most people have liberty. They can go where they want and do the things they feel like doing. But most people are also slaves to their impulses. They have grown reactive rather than proactive, meaning that they are like sea foam pounding against a rocky shore, going in whatever direction the tide might take them. If they are spending time with their families and someone from work calls with a crisis, they hit the ground running, never stopping to think which activity is more vital to their overall well-being and to their life's purpose. So, after all I have observed in my life, both here in the West and in the East, I say that such people have liberty but lack freedom. They lack a key ingredient to a meaningful, enlightened life. The freedom to see the forest beyond the trees. The freedom to choose what is right over what seems pressing. I couldn't help but agree with Julian. Sure, I had little to complain about. I had a great family, a cozy home, and a bustling law practice. But I really couldn't say that I had achieved freedom. My pager was just as much an appendage as my right arm. I was always on the run. I never seemed to have the time to communicate deeply with Jenny. And quiet time for myself in the foreseeable future was about as likely as me winning the Boston Marathon. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that I had probably never even tasted the nectar of true boundless freedom when I was younger. I guess I really was a slave to my weaker impulses. I always did what everyone else told me I should be doing. And building willpower will offer me more freedom? Freedom is like a house. You build it brick by brick. The first brick you should lay is willpower. This quality inspires you to do what is right in any given moment. It gives you the energy to act with courage. It gives you the control to live the life you have imagined, rather than accepting the life that you have. Julian also noted the many practical benefits that the cultivation of discipline would bring. Believe it or not,
Developing the power of your own will can erase the worry habit, keep you healthy, and give you far more energy than you have ever had. You see, John, self-control is really nothing more than mind control. Will is the king of mental powers. When you master your mind, you master your life. Mental mastery starts with being able to control every thought that you think. When you have developed the ability to discard all weak thoughts and focus only on those that are positive and good, positive and good actions will follow. Soon you will start attracting all that is positive and good into your life. Here's an example. Let's say one of your personal development goals is to get up every morning at 6 a.m. and go for a run around that park behind your place. Let's pretend it is now the middle of winter, and your alarm wakes you from a deep, restful sleep. Your first impulse is to hit the snooze button and return to your slumber. Perhaps you will live up to your exercise resolution tomorrow. This pattern continues for a few days until you decide that you are too old to change your ways and the physical fitness goal was too unrealistic. You know me too well, I offered sincerely. Now, let's consider an alternative scenario. It is still the dead of winter. The alarm goes off and you start to think of staying in bed. But instead of being a slave to your habits, you challenge them with more powerful thoughts. You start to picture in your mind's eye how you will look, feel, and act when you are in peak physical shape. You hear the many compliments your colleagues at the office offer you as you saunter past them with a svelte, trim physique. You focus on all that you can accomplish with the increased energy a regular exercise program will bring. No more nights spent in front of the television because you are too tired to do anything else after your long day in court. Your days are filled with vitality, enthusiasm, and meaning. But say I do this, and I still feel like going back to sleep rather than going running. Initially, for the first few days, it will be a little difficult, and you will feel like going back to your old habits. But Yogi Raman believed very strongly in one timeless principle in particular. Positive always overcomes negative. So if you continue to wage war against the weaker thoughts that might have silently crept into the palace of your mind over the years, eventually they will see that they are unwanted and leave like visitors who know they are not welcome. You mean to tell me that thoughts are physical things? Yes. And they are fully in your control. It is just as easy to think positive thoughts as it is to think negative ones. Then why do so many people worry and focus on all the negative information in our world? Because they have not learned the art of self-control and disciplined thinking. Most people I have spoken to have no idea that they have the power to control every single thought they think, every second of every minute of every day. They believe that thoughts just happen and have never realized that if you don't take the time to start controlling your thoughts, they will control you. When you start to focus on good thoughts only and refuse to think the bad ones through sheer willpower, I promise you they will shrivel up very quickly. So if I want to have the inner strength to get up earlier, eat less, read more, worry less, be more patient or be more loving, all I have to do is exert my will to cleanse my thoughts. When you control your thoughts, you control your mind. When you control your mind, you control your life. And once you reach the stage of being in total control of your life, you become the master of your destiny. I needed to hear this. Through the course of this strange yet inspiring evening, I had gone from being a skeptical litigator, carefully studying a hotshot lawyer-turned-yogi, to a believer whose eyes had been opened for the first time in many years. I wished Jenny could hear all this. Actually, I wished my kids could hear this wisdom too. I knew it would affect them as it had me. I had always planned on being a better family man and living more fully, but I always found that I was too busy putting out all those little brush fires of life that seemed so pressing. Maybe this was a weakness, a lack of self-control, an inability to see the forest for the trees, perhaps. Life was passing by so quickly. It seemed like just yesterday that I was a young law student, full of energy and enthusiasm. I dreamed of becoming a political